Good morning. When some of us arrived early this morning at about 5:45, I think it was 50 degrees in here, so it feels pretty nice now. So there's three things that I'd like to talk about today. I titled my talk, Receiving Everything with an Open Heart. But I really don't have time to talk about everything, so I'm going to talk about three things. One is receiving the beauty and healing power of nature. Another is receiving the words and hearts of each other through counsel practice. And I'll talk about what that is if you don't know what that is. And then I also want to talk a little bit about the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee, which is a committee here at Clouds and Water who receive feedback, concerns, and grievances on behalf of the community. So it might seem like a lot of different things, but hopefully with the sort of underlying theme of receiving, it won't feel too disparate to talk about those three things. So I've been thinking a lot about receiving. On Thursday, ended a three-day solitary retreat on Lake Superior's North Shore. And so I've been thinking a lot about receiving. One thing I received is the gift of a stay at a wonderful cabin. Flying Fish, Barbara Murphy, and her husband Sam own a cabin, at least for now. They're selling it, but anyway, it's on the North Shore near Tofte, near Lutzen and Tofte. So I had the chance to be there with my family between Christmas and over New Year's, and then stayed there on my own to just have a chance to be alone and to do some meditation and just to receive. So every day I was able to look out at the lake and the trees and the snow and receive the gift of their beauty. And also receive the gifts of the sound of the crashing waves on the shore and the sound of the crackling fires in the wood stove. And I felt like really that I was storing up beauty and serenity. It felt like receiving it and just kind of like storing it up so that I can be more open and equanimous when I return to my everyday life. And so far, so good. So what is it about being in natural beauty that seems to do that for us? I don't know. But it's interesting. There was an article in this month's National Geographic that talked about the healing power of being in nature and even simulated nature. So I'll just share a few gems from that article. So, you know, for a long time, many poets and philosophers and artists and, you know, even theologians have talked about the beauty and the healing power of the natural world. So that's throughout history. But now, more recently, there have been actual scientific studies which kind of are proving what the artists and philosophers and theologians already knew. So it's kind of interesting. One study of outward bound participants, you know, the people who go out in the wilderness, found that they performed 50% better on creative problem-solving tasks after 3 days of wilderness backpacking and wilderness experience. That's really pretty amazing, 50% better. There was another study, researchers from the University of Exeter Medical School in England found that people who lived near more green space reported less mental stress, and even after that was adjusted for income, education, and employment, which are other things which can, you know, cause mental stress. If you have low income or less opportunity for education or are unemployed. But even when they balanced for that, the green space showed less, people reported less stress. There was another Dutch research study that found a lower incidence of 15 diseases, including depression, anxiety, heart disease, diabetes, asthma, and migraines, in people who lived within half a mile of green space. I'm not sure exactly how they're defining green space, but I'm imagining it could be even like just a square block of a city park, just something where it's, you know, there's just nature there. There's no other activity other than nature. And here's another great one, a research project surveying over 31,000 Toronto residents found that those living on blocks, they did a block-by-block study, and those people living on blocks with more trees, so even if there were houses, but just in the blocks, there were more trees, showed a boost in heart and metabolic health equivalent to what one would experience from a $20,000 gain in income. And then one that I found especially interesting, since I'm a meditator, is a Swedish researcher found that subjects who were stressed with a math test or a simulated job interview had their heart rates quickly return or recover to normal when they were exposed to a virtual forest with singing birds. So, you know, as a meditator, I can close my eyes and imagine a forest pretty easily. Or if I'm not good at visualizing, I might be able to, you know, conjure up some kind of imaginary sound or imaginary feeling of being in a forest. So, and also as a meditator, I think that even if we can't get away for three or more days of a wilderness backpacking or 3 days of a solitary retreat, or if we can't right now live in a place with more trees or plug ourselves into a virtual reality forest, we can cultivate how we receive what natural beauty is available to us right now. So I've been thinking about how we receive in our everyday lives. Do I really take the time and energy to notice and receive the beauty that is present out my kitchen window or in the eyes of my loved ones? And how much extra time does it really take to do that? 1 or 2 seconds extra? It doesn't really take a lot of extra time. So it's not really time that's the issue. If I don't receive the beauty that's right in front of my eyes, which sometimes I don't, it's because of my habit energy of being busy or feeling a need to be in control or thinking ahead too much to what's the next thing, that I'm not noticing the thing that's right here. So when I take the extra 1 or 2 seconds of time and shift my habit energy so I can really receive the beauty and the goodness that's available to me in every moment, I also notice that I'm more open to receiving whatever arises, good or bad. And this is really what we're doing in Zazen, in our meditation practice, isn't it? Receiving whatever arises, sitting, breathing, receiving whatever arises. breath after breath. So when I'm practicing like this, I notice and receive the good, of course, and that nourishes me, that nurtures me, that helps me to store up that serenity and equanimity. And then it's more likely that I can receive the difficulties that might arise with grace and tenderness. I might, for example, notice that I'm feeling defensive before I lash out in reaction to something that someone has said or done. I might pause and actually receive the words and actions, and also receive my reaction. So that's not excluded. And if I receive in that way, then I can respond in a way that is kind and helpful and beautiful. But it doesn't always happen like that. Even after practicing for a long time, our habit energy has a way of taking over. And even when it makes us unhappy, that habit energy has a way of taking over. So, for example, I have an unfortunate habit of reading blame or criticism into things my husband tells me. Doesn't matter what. Can be very even, like, if someone said something like, "I noticed the dishes aren't done," that's not blame, but I hear it as blame, like, "Oh, I should have done them, and you're blaming me." So it's very interesting. So because I do a lot of weddings, I sometimes do some research onto what makes a marriage last. There's lots of great stuff on the internet. So there's this one site called Your Tango, people tangoing. And they have an article called The Secret to Our Marriage, and it's couples who've been married 15 years or more, and kind of saying what they, their advice or what they say works. So one husband said this: "I tell my wife, if something I say can be interpreted two ways, and one of those ways makes you sad or angry, I meant the other one." So although that quote was not from my husband of 28 years, it may have been. And I feel like it's really good advice for me to know that, hey, they didn't necessarily mean it that way. I can choose to receive it in a different way. I can receive the information that comes to me in a different way. And try to listen from the heart. Really listen from the heart. And listen to everything from the heart. So this segues into the next thing I want to talk about in terms of receiving. Because we have a practice here at Clouds and Water of listening from the heart. So it's a way of receiving things that people say. It's called counsel practice, and I think it's good to review every now and then what that is. So I'll say a little bit about it. Well, first of all, just on the sort of surface level, the form of counsel practice is usually sitting in a circle, having a talking piece. When someone has the talking piece in their hand, they have the floor and they can speak and no one can interrupt them or add on to what they're saying. That's just them speaking. And everyone else, so the majority, are practicing listening from the heart and just really taking in what they're hearing from the heart center. And one thing we don't often have time to talk about when we're sort of doing the preliminaries for counsel practice is what are called the three tenets of practice, or the three treasures of practice, of counsel practice. And those three treasures are not knowing, bearing witness, and appropriate action. So not knowing is also called the oneness of Buddha. So that's the treasures. The three treasures are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So not knowing refers to the oneness of Buddha. Bearing witness refers to the diversity of Dharma. And appropriate action refers to the harmony of Sangha, or the harmony of the community. So not knowing, that's a really an important thing for receiving, that we participate with a spirit of not knowing, of letting go of fixed ideas and not clinging to one point of view. So of course we can do this. We don't have to be sitting in a circle with the talking piece in order to practice this. So this is a value that we can cultivate even in our everyday communication. But somehow it's a little bit easier when we're in this more formal setting. Like, okay, now we're really listening from the heart and we're really practicing this not knowing. So when someone brings something up that we might think is a criticism, or someone brings something up that we might disagree with, instead of formulating our, you know, reaction and our response, our rebuttal, we're just taking it in, receiving from the heart. Like, oh, I wonder what they really mean by that. I want to really understand them. What are they saying? And listening to their point of view, and maybe, you know, temporarily just going along with their point of view to see what that's like. So this not knowing is also maintaining a spaciousness of mind and just receiving whatever arises. So one of the things, again, going back to my three-day solitary retreat on the North Shore, I felt like I was really cultivating that spaciousness of mind. For me, looking out at this magnificent lake, this huge lake, has a kind of calming quality, and there's a spaciousness in the visual field of the huge lake, so then it helps me cultivate this spaciousness of mind and spaciousness of heart so that I can receive whatever arises. So that's not knowing. Then bearing witness is really listening to the other's truth. So that someone else is talking and we're listening to their truth, step into the other's truth. See our own ego process. What keeps us stuck? So if we notice that we are having a reaction, we are forming a rebuttal, we are, you know, kind of getting defensive, then, okay, yeah, that's my process. And so we can also receive that and not have judgment about that, or at least invite ourselves not to have judgment about that. And then if we do those things, listening to the other's truth, stepping into the other's truth, seeing our own ego process and not having and receiving that and not having judgment, then we have the chance to be totally present with what's happening. So we can really be present with what's happening. So that's the bearing witness. And then the third tenet or third treasure of counsel practice is appropriate action, or the harmony of Sangha. So here's where I think sometimes those of us who are kind of a can-do, or let's get this figured out, let's solve the problem, you know, we want to jump into action right away. Like, okay, someone brought up a problem, and then, like, okay, how do we fix it? So instead, with appropriate action, we let the action flow out of the process. So like in a council, we have a chance to wait and kind of hear all the different views. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to be in a hurry to get to a solution. Actually, one of the things is just building our relationship, you know, getting to know each other. And even if it's something that needs a solution, if we didn't reach a solution that day or that session, it's okay, because it's better to wait and have the solution be something that really flows from the process than to kind of artificially, you know, reach an endpoint that maybe is a solution that's going to make some people feel unhappy or hurt or excluded. So with appropriate action, we're letting the ideas and the feelings arise and let the problem solving grow out of the process. And it really does work. I mean, we've used counsel practice to solve some pretty thorny problems at Clouds and Water. And it's been amazing to me how it's like, oh, it really does work. And also, I've used it at home, you know, with my family, you know, sometimes just with two of us, and using that kind of counsel values of listening and even sometimes having the talking piece, you know, so that we each can just have our say without having someone else add on. And it can really be wonderful. So right now at Clouds and Water, we have counsel practice on a regular basis, usually at the end of the session of the retreat. We do a circle, a talking circle. Sometimes we'll have a counsel practice as part of a board meeting or a staff meeting or a volunteer meeting. If, you know, if it feels like, okay, it would be helpful to have this discussion in a more formal way where we're really making sure that we're listening from the heart and being open to not knowing. And, you know, of course, we try to do this all the time, but sometimes you do need the form to help you remember. So we do that. And then, as I said, you know, you can do it at home, too. So that's partly why we occasionally talk about how to do this practice. So this also kind of relates to natural beauty, going back to my natural beauty theme, because I feel like listening in this way and receiving in this way through counsel practice, we can practice receiving the natural beauty of each other's hearts and each other's shining faces and each other's being. So there is a natural beauty there if we stop and notice it. So that's hard. It's probably harder for the researchers to do study about that. But I think it's true. So if that's true, then it's really good news, because for those of us who don't, you know, have the opportunity to live in the green space or go to the solitary retreat or do those things, we can say, instead of just saying, well, I'm out of luck, we can say, well, wait a minute, there's all these flowers around me that I can pay attention to and notice and be nurtured by. So the third thing that I want to talk about is a special group of volunteers at Clouds and Water who are really all about receiving. So they're those who serve on the Ethics and Reconciliation Committee. We also call it the EAR Committee, kind of a funny acronym, but it's because of listening. So it's the EAR Committee or EAR Council, because they do a kind of, they embody the values of counsel practice in their receiving. And we'll have a little ceremony today at the end of the, after the Dharma talk, to honor a couple of people who've served on that committee for many years, and also recognizing some new volunteers to that committee. So the EAR committee is set up to receive a grievance or a concern of from any participant at Clouds and Water, and their job is to deeply receive feedback from the community if there's a problem that maybe can't be resolved directly between the parties. And in particular, they are set up to hear grievances if someone feels that our ethical guidelines are not being followed. So it's also good once in a while to review the ethical guidelines. I think these are posted, or if they're not, they will be soon again on the bulletin board in the hallway toward the going toward the bathrooms. The ethical guidelines are basically following the precepts. So there's the three pure precepts, which really cover everything. Do no harm, do good, and free all beings. So they're, you know, so in other words, we really don't have to say anything more. But because those are so broad, we do say something more. And also we would say the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the three refuges are, like I said, the three tenets, not knowing, bearing witness, and appropriate action, we could say. That's one way of thinking about that in terms of ethics. And then there's also the 10 grave precepts, or when I taught it to the teenagers, we called it the 10 great precepts. Grave meaning serious, solemn, but we thought, well, they're great. So those are not killing, that includes like killing someone's idea or, you know, sort of emotional killing. So not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not speaking falsely, no taking intoxicants, not gossiping, not blaming, not attaching, not indulging in anger. And then to make sure the three treasures are covered once more, the last one is not thinking ill of the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So, and I know I talked about this a little bit last June, but just to say again, all members of the community are responsible for the community's well-being and to uphold the precepts and to express concerns if they feel that harm is being done. That's the way to have a strong community. A strong community isn't necessarily one where just, oh, no harm is ever done. Because that's not human. We're humans, so harm gets done. But then what happens? Do we have a process where it can be addressed? And that, you know, like I said, the EAR committee can be a part of that process. So also with the ethical guidelines, teachers have special obligations. So this is just a reminder that everyone should know that teachers here have special obligations to practice right conduct in relationships. So right conduct, you know, that covers a lot. But I'll just say right conduct in general, and then in particular, to refrain from becoming sexually involved with students, and also to honor the student's privacy by maintaining confidentiality. So there is some, the teachers, the teacher Rio, the group of teachers, sometimes will meet together and there's, you know, one teacher might be working with a student and say, I'm not really sure how to help this person. And so the teachers together might talk about a student. But within that teacher group, we maintain confidentiality. So we don't, like, casually talk about that, you know, sort of over lunch with other staff and volunteers. You know, it's within a very circumscribed container that confident. So we feel like that confidentiality is kept. But I think it's important for people to know that, because then if you feel uncomfortable with that, you can talk to your teacher about that. And that's a way of, you know, uncovering what's the best process going forward so that everyone can feel safe. Also, an ethical guideline of our community in general is that we're committed to creating an environment where students are free from sexual harassment. So that extends not just to about teachers, but it also extends to each other. You know, how we are as a community, what kind of vibe, what kind of atmosphere we're creating as a community. So one thing is that we ask current students to be very careful about expressing sexual or romantic interest in new members or visitors. you know, right away. We don't want to, like, pounce on someone right away. You know, someone is coming here, probably not their first goal is to meet a romantic partner. It might be one of their goals, but probably their first goal is spiritual. So we want to honor that be sensitive to visitors and new members and create a safe and nurturing spiritual environment for them and for everyone. So we can receive them in the best possible way. So then, sometimes when we have these guidelines, but sometimes, you know, something goes wrong. You know, someone is a human being and does something and it's, you know, things aren't quite right and someone feels hurt. So then there's many different ways you can do that. Of course, you can go to the person directly. You can ask for, can we have a meeting that's a council? Maybe you have bring another friend in and do that. So it's you can do it on your own. But maybe that you try that and it didn't work, or maybe you don't know enough people or you don't feel comfortable. So then the ear committee is another option for you if something is going wrong. And you can make your grievance or your concern made known verbally or in writing. And I think that, again, on the how to contact the ear committee, it's just ear@cloudsandwater.org if you want to email. And there's also the names of the committee members. Should be very soon, if not already, posted on the bulletin board. I know I saw an email that Lillian was planning on updating it because, you know, like I said, we have some members leaving and some new members. So I think that new list will be there pretty soon. All right. I just want to say a little bit then also about the reconciliation process, because at first we were just kind of set up to say, okay, we have ethical guidelines and we have a grievance procedure. Like, here's what you do if there's a grievance. But we didn't really have a set sort of format for what, okay, then what happens? How do we reconcile after, you know, are there some guidelines for that? And actually, some members of the EAR committee worked on how that last piece, that reconciliation piece, you know, what we would say about that. And so we have a wonderful document, and I'm pretty sure if you go on, look on our website, you can download a PDF of the whole document, which has our ethical guidelines, the grievance procedure, and the reconciliation process. So if you want to look at that. But I'll just mention a few things, because there's some guiding principles of the reconciliation process. And it's principles that the EAR committee uses, but it's also guiding principles for a healthy community or a healthy family. So one is empathy. And these, of course, relate to counsel practice and relate to receiving, all of them as I'm looking at them. Empathy, so recognizing and acknowledging the feelings and needs of the other and the self. And yourself gets included in empathy. Practicing nonviolent communication, bearing witness, being present, having generosity and compassion. And then deep listening. Listening from the heart, listening with openness to the words and feelings and needs of the speaker. So not just the words, but the listening to the truth, the deep truth from the other in what they're saying. Don't know mind comes up again. Suspending the thought that I know someone else's motives or hurts or feelings or the reasons behind a situation. Suspending the thought that I already know everything about my own motives and hurts and feelings. So just really entering into the not know. No one version of the truth. So often we're, you know, think, well, what's the objective truth? What's the one thing that's right? So in this reconciliation process, we recognize the subjectivity. There's no one version of the truth. Each of us has our own story about the events around us, and no one story encapsulates the truth. And then there's taking responsibility. So we recognize the interconnection, interdependence with each other, and we identify and take responsibility for our own contribution. So our own contribution to the separation or the hurt or the problem, and then what's our own contribution toward the process of reconciliation? What can we do? Which is related to appropriate action. So that's, then we begin to identify direct and practical steps to help the people who are involved to make amends for past ethical breaches or hurtful behavior, and how to make more skillful, kind, appropriate choices in the future. So it's really, you know, sometimes the ear committee can go for years without doing any work at all. It's possible. It's happened. But when they do have the chance to do work, it's very deep and very critical, important. And through this process, I think one of the things that the ear committee does is help us to see the beautiful trees that are in our Sangha, each of us standing like a tree, and help us to look into the eyes of our fellow community members and see ourselves there. See no separation. So we can go out and commune with actual trees, even when it's cold. Maybe look at them from your inside window. We can commune with the actual trees and be nourished, but we also can be nourished by the trees that are in this room and in our families, in each other. So we have a little bit of time, about 5 minutes or so. I don't know, we didn't synchronize our...
10:15.
Okay, good. 7 minutes. So if there's comments or questions or observations about receiving or anything really that you want to bring up. Yes, Kathleen. Sometimes, and sometimes not. It's necessary to use a name, but if it's not necessary, then we don't use a name. And the reason it's sometimes necessary is because sometimes it's like if other teachers are going to be interacting with that student, it might be helpful to kind of know what the situation is. But that is another case where a student, now knowing that, could say when they're speaking with the teacher, you know, they could ask for another degree of confidentiality, and then the teacher might say, well, I'm not able to give that. There's sometimes when they're, you know, when we're not, because we have to take care of ourselves too. But thank you for asking that. Yes.
And not a lot of green space and beauty, and I hope we can do something with the outside exterior of our building, mm-hmm. to provide a visual solace.
Yeah.
Because not everybody has a chance to get to where this green. I wish there was 10 of me.
Well, so you're planting that seed,
yeah.
And
it's in my heart.
Yeah, but so maybe there's other gardener type people who are interested, and come spring we could do some things. We could plant some trees too. I mean, that would be, you know, there might be like along the edges, there might be a place where we could plant a tree or a bush or flowers. Yeah. Yes.
So there's a book called, I think it's called Last Child in the Woods. Have you heard of it?
Uh-uh.
But it has a lot of those studies in it. But one of them is, and I was thinking about it, kids do significantly better in school if they have at home or even at school a window with a tree outside of it.
Uh-huh.
Which we do have a lot of. I was appreciating.
Yeah. Well, I've noticed also a huge difference between my office at Clouds and Water downtown and the one here. I didn't have a window at all, and to see outside, I could go outside my office, and then in that room in Compassion Hall, there were windows that looked on a brick wall, and then. But if I looked way in the distance at the Zendo, I could look through the doors or the windows of the doors, I could at least see, there was also, it was just a street, but there was more space, and so there was light coming in. And now I still have a little window. It's this size, or two of them, two little windows that size. But one of them looks out on a bush, and so there's, in the spring, summer, and fall, there's leaves, and now there's at least, there's still branches, and it's amazing. I mean, I the quality of feeling, so that's important. But one thing that I did at the old place was I tried to have, intentionally, like if there was a flower on the altar, I would go and look at it. To take that in. And I would have a screensaver on my computer that would come up that would have something natural that I could look at. So I think that it's great if we can actually get out in nature, but if we can't, then there's other things that we can do to help. Now, the other thing I want to mention is that as far as getting out in nature, they said it's only if you're comfortable. If you're being pelted by hail or swarmed by mosquitoes, it's not going to have the positive effect. So, yes.
When you discussed the ear committee, I thought about the difference between forgiveness and reconciliation.
Hmm. Right. Yep.
Either it's not right, not the right time, or they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that and what Cloud's experience has been with
that? Well, I'll just say that I think that forgiveness is, something that's like internal. So even if the other person doesn't want to reconcile, or even if I don't want to reconcile, I don't want to have a relationship with the person who harmed me, still I can, internally cultivate non-hatred, cultivate understanding, where the other person was coming from. So, because sometimes, it's for our own, it's what is the best thing is to, sometimes to say, well, actually, no, I'm not going to step into that relationship again. So then, but I don't have to be brittle about it. So that's, I guess, what I would say. And does anyone else have a thought about that, Jenny?
Yeah, but that's the important part, that reconciliation doesn't necessarily mean now we can go all back to where how we were before.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes reconciliation is just like, okay, this has happened, this has changed things, this is where it is now, and I understand it better now, and I can accept that, whichever way it is.
Yeah, I think we're done. Thank you. That was good timing, unless you've been waiting long, have you?
No.
All right, good.
Okay.